That's always the excuse.
So what that means is all the other blocks except for the disciplinary and the psychiatric clinic and the reception part are general population, and it doesn't matter which one you live in, it's supposedly the same level of security and privileges. The idea with the honors block is that if they have that as something to shoot towards inside the prison, behavior might, you know, it's sort of like holding a little bone out in front of a dog, he's going to behave a little better. So they're trying to expand their facilities in that way. But there's no money.
That speaks to the whole way that they have the prison system set up, both inside a particular institution and within the institution as a whole. The...
Is that H-O-L-E or W-H-O-L-E?
Yeah, W-H-O-L-E, right. The general policy, the general practice of the prison is to break people down. The motto, when you come into quarantine, the motto that you're given to govern your life by is do your own time. Don't get involved in other people's troubles, you see. Mind your own business, do your own time, and everything will be all right. At the same time as they advance this slogan, they also have a practice. Mr. Dwayne Scholes, the administrative assistant to the warden, spoke to me one time in a special interview and mentioned that, oh, we know everything that goes on in here. We have plenty of snitches. We know 95% of the activity that goes on in the penitentiary at any given time. So their policy is to, anything that's had, like any kind of illegal activity that's going on, from gambling to homosexual relationships between inmates to people smoking dope or getting pills in or something like that, to inmates talking about political activities and talking about politics and things like that. Any kind of illegal activity going on, and that includes also, I had a friend who was locked up in the disciplinary block, indefinite maximum security, for having a number of eggs from the mess hall in his cell, you see. He had gotten a bunch of eggs through some clandestine channel and was selling them for cigarettes or something. Cigarettes, like, this is the currency in the penitentiary, you know, the packages of cigarettes or a box. Even if there's any reefer inside, you can buy joints for like two cartons of cigarettes for a joint, you know. And they have what they call snitches. And snitches are the people who are engaged in writing little letters to the deputy warden. Maybe I have some. I have this great, we just acquired my prison file from the Michigan Department of Corrections. It may be the first time in the history of the Michigan Department of Corrections that this has been brought to light, this kind of. They keep these records. The inmates can't see their own records, you see. Only police agencies can see the records, but we happen to have a federal judge order the Department of Corrections to give up these records. Let me see if I can find this. Sometime in the course of this course, I hope to systematize these and make a presentation so we can see. We have here a memo from Paul Chase, Acting Director of Corrections, from Warden Johnson. Subject: disruptive tactics of the radical left, a prison strike. Very interesting document. Very interesting. I hope we'll make copies of some of the more scintillating of these documents and pass them on. They have little memos to each other when Sinclair's parents call up, tell them this, stuff like that.
They have a file on me.
Sinclair arriving at Marquette, try to place him someplace where he won't be able to corrupt too many other inmates. I don't know where this will be. This is a report. Maybe just if we read some of this stuff, it'll give you a better example, then we can get back on the abstract level.
Maybe we begin sort of at the beginning and sort of talk about what happens when you first enter the prison, what kinds of questions.
Yeah, this is, I just found this. This is a report they made on me after you take all the tests and talk to the. You go in, and this is another correction that I want to point out to you that we have to make on here. Where it says 6, and then the next one will be 7, there's a little thing there, that's called the bubble. A little thing there. That's where you're admitted. That's where prisoners are admitted. You see? Prisoners are brought there from county jails and turned over to the penitentiary. They walk in. First you walk in, you're brought in chains like this, and your feet are probably chained, coming from a county jail. You're brought into the bubble, they take them, and you enter here, and the first cell door opens, and you walk in here, and they shut it, and then they open another one. You go in here, and this is like a bullpen, or just a big space, you know, with bars on either side. And then they call you in from the bullpen one at a time. You go in through another sliding bar door, and the reception center, or the receiving center is there. You take all your clothes off, take all your stuff out of your pockets, you take your wallet, all your pictures and identification cards and anything like that. And you turn all that over to the officer, the corporal who's stationed there, who has inmates assisting him. And then they put you in a shower and spray you with bug juice, you know, make sure you haven't got any crabs or any kind of weird lice or anything like that. And then you're given a white coverall, which usually doesn't fit, and you put it on, and a pair of scuffs. Claw scuffs that they give you. And then you go over and give all your information to an inmate who takes it all down on paper. You don't know that they're inmates, you know. They act like they're members of the administration or something, you know. And, pardon? Well, see, they're inmates that have been there. In fact, I think the ones that work in the bubble live in trustee division. So usually they have, like, maybe street clothes on, or you know, maybe a pair of black pants and a white shirt or something like that. The prison issue is 2 blue denim shirts, pullover shirts, and 2 pairs of blue twill like work pants, and 1 pair of high top shoes, and without the little pocket for the knife in them, and 2 pairs of Grace cotton socks and 2 lightweight blue twill jackets. That's your regular issue, you see. But after inmates who aren't in quarantine and aren't in the hole, like can have clothes sent into them, they just September 13th, the afternoon of the day that the people were murdered in Attica, they changed the clothing regulations at Jackson to allow any color clothes in now. So, and then after about a month after that, after we hassled for a while, they let bell-bottom pants in. So, and dashikis, they started allowing dashikis about a year and a half ago. They had to be solid color until September 13th. Now you can get colored dashikis, you see. I mean, so I could be in there dressed like this, you know, except for not having boots on, you know. So, I mean, now they might have any kind of clothes on, you know. And you don't know, I mean, you know, when you first go to prison, you expect the prisoners to have stripes on or, you know, some kind of weird uniform, you know, and then there's somebody with, like, street clothes on, so you think that they're part of the, and they act like it. I mean, there's inmates who act very little like inmates, you know, they act very much like pigs, you see, so, and of course, they're the ones that get these kind of jobs. So they're in the bow, they take all your information down, you tell them your religion and your family and, you know, your relations and all this stuff, little realizing that this is the information on which your visiting list and your correspondence list and the church you want to go to inside and stuff like that is all set by this, you see. So anybody who ever gets sent to the penitentiary, if you want to get anybody put on your visiting list that shouldn't be on there, you should tell them right at the beginning that they're your brother or your sister or something like that the minute that you go in. See, then you won't have any hassle with it. I understand that because I wish I would have known that, you know. So you fill out this stuff, then you get a shave and a haircut if you need them. When I went in 69, when you went into quarantine, you couldn't have any facial hair at all. If you had a mustache, you shaved your mustache off. And you could grow a neatly trimmed mustache to the corner of the lip once you were inside. Again, through the struggle of inmates over a period of years, now they allow goatees and mustaches and sideburns, and the hair, black inmates can have relatively righteous natural hairdos, and they're lightening up a little bit on the military haircuts. You know, now you can have hair 3 inches long and stuff. But you get your hair cut there, and then you go, you sit on a bench until everybody else who came in with you is processed, and then they take you through a big door here, and down a ramp, and another door slides open, and bam, there you, then you're in 7 block. 7 block and 8 block at this time are quarantine blocks. When this new facility gets built in Ypsilanti, all of this will take place here in Washtenaw County. You know, this is where they'll be bringing people and admitting them to prison and putting them through this procedure, and they will do what I'm describing as 7 and 8 block will be the function of this reception diagnostic center that'll be in Washtenaw County. 7 block, okay, on the same map, we have down in the right-hand corner two kinds of cell block organization. 7 block, you have the bottom kind, opposite cells. You have the 5 galleries of cells with like 52 cells on a side. So that's 104 cells on the first, on the ground level, that's base, and 104 cells on first gallery, second gallery, third gallery, and fourth gallery. So you have 520 cells in this block. The younger prisoners are assigned to cells at 7 block. The older prisoners over 25, I think, are assigned to 8 block. And of course, 8 block is less crowded, and it's probably not as big as 7 block. I've never been in 8 block, so I don't know. But I imagine it's constructed on the same organizational principle with the cells on the sides and a large open space in the middle. See, 7 block is like completely self-contained. When you're in quarantine, it used to be quarantine. It used to be such that you went into quarantine from the minute you entered that bullpen and the bubble. You didn't say a word for 45 days, except at certain specified times. Used to be completely silent, you see, so when you were in quarantine, you were completely quarantined, you were just like a guinea pig in a cage, and they run these tests and things on you. Now it's just like anywhere else, except you are contained, and 7 block is a unit. They have, on the base area, in this space in between, on the base, they have the dining area, and they have a kitchen at the end. They have like Like at this end of the room, they have a kitchen, and then they have the dining area here, which is like plastic formica tables with four seats around. You know, it used to be long benches. It was like troughs, you know, that they would lead you into. They're still in Six Pack. They have that. They have the tables with four people around the tables, and you're seated when you go eat. You're unlocked by gallery, and you go down. And you're seated four to a table, first four at this table, next four at this table. So again, it used to be that you'd go in single file in the order of the cells, and you wouldn't be able to choose who you sat with or anything like this. Now you can go with other people on your gallery. So if you got a friend who's five or six cells down, you can wait up for them, and they can come down, and you can sit together. But Seven Block is self-contained. It has the dining, it has like the kitchen, the cafeteria kitchen thing here, the serving area, and the dining area comes, say, in proportion to this room would come about to here, about to the edge of this table. That would all be the dining area. And then back, then there's an open space, and then back here, is this essentially correct? Mm-hmm. I haven't been in there in some time. Then you have the testing and office, the testing and counselor's offices here in Seven Block. Seven Block is where, when a prisoner is brought in, he is tested and put through a diagnostic, series of diagnostic tests or something, right? Okay. And they're supposed to determine what your IQ is, what kind of schooling you've had, how many smarts you got, you know, what you can do, what kind of, all to be supposed to, you know, kind of scope you out to see what they can do to rehabilitate you. You know, study the nature of your crime and take psychiatric tests and the MMPI and Rorschach tests and Army tests and all kinds of stuff like that. And this goes on for a period usually of a month. Usually the testing period is 30 days. Usually anymore, they keep people in there longer because they haven't got enough room to send them another, but they have to wait for people to go home. So it all sounds really on the up and up, you know, and the whole testing procedure. But there's no, what is the ratio of counselors? Have you got some propaganda there?
I was trying to break down, I went through this whole thing with a pencil and tried to add up the staff because they give you the total number of staff within the prison. And then they break down different parts of the staff where they appear. In the Reception Diagnostic Center, there's one superintendent, an assistant superintendent, two psychologists, one psychometrist, one vocational counselor, six social workers, and a custodial staff of 32 uniformed personnel. So you got 32 guards and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 13 or so non-custodial people involved. And that ratio is a lot higher in that part than you're ever going to find the rest of the prison. Some of that staff is borrowed from the psychiatric clinic.
Right.
They share resources as far as the psychologists go. I could not, from this thing, find out how many people there were involved in counseling. They're sort of vague in a few places about how many individuals are used for administrative staff. So they can imply, in a way this might imply that there are more people involved with counseling and treatment than there are. But the ratio is, well, you have one counselor on every block. That's 500 to 1. You have the special activities department, which has two men administering all the programs directly and then administration going along with it. People like Jerry Hansen on your, he'll appear here. He did not really contact the inmates as far as I could tell. He's administration. As it breaks down, the ratio is probably something like 500 to 1 on counseling and at your opportunities for contact with a counselor, somebody who's a professional person. About 500 to 1. I'm having to guess on that. I'd say you'd be lucky if it was something like that. I think the people in treatment would be counted as counselors, the administrative people in treatment. The cell blocks would have about 20 or so.
What?
Well, how many altogether would they have in the cell blocks that they call counselors?
Yeah. I don't know. The cell block has one counselor assigned to it. And he comes in a couple days a week.
Yeah. It's, again, these people don't have to be there every day. So it's pretty poor.
And they call you out, you know, they call a prisoner out who has left a note for 2 or 3 days wanting to see him. They call him down there and, all right, what do you want this time? You know, that's the way that the counselor, that's the way your counseling goes, you know. Unless you could go to a counselor with some kind of snitch tail on somebody, you know, ready to tell them something about somebody that's doing something that they want to know about, then you'll get treated real nice, you know. That's what we started out to say, you know, is that that's the way. You see, if you will do, it's like he was talking about the honor blocks. You get in the honor block by kissing ass is essentially how you get in the honor block, you know. The way you get anything in the penitentiary is essentially by bootlicking and toadying and snitching on people. And this is the way that it said, this is the kind of activity that they encourage. This is the kind of activity that they hold up as, this is what they reward, you know.
There's a statement in here under the treatment department, page 3. Various kinds of counseling provided with the major emphasis on group counseling. Well.
They have 6-month waiting lists for people to get into group counseling, you see.
Yeah,
they do things like you go to the parole board. A guy goes to the parole board, and they say, well, anyway, looked at your record here, and this is a 5-minute parole board interview, you know. I looked at your record here, and we think you need group counseling. You haven't got no group counseling on here. Bring us 6 months of group counseling, and we'll talk about it. Goodbye. And that's your parole hearing, you see. So you go from there and try and get on group counseling, and there's a 6-month waiting list, you see. I mean, and then you just go through with 3 or 4 months of anguish, you know. I mean, these guys are just on the verge of flipping out behind stuff like this, you know. I can get a parole if I can get group counseling. I can't get in group counseling. Here goes another 6 months of my life, you know, or a year. They're writing letters to the, you know, maybe after 3 or 4 months they might get it straightened out, you know. And then they put them in a group counseling course, and then they'll go back and probably get a flop for one reason or another. Flop is, you know, they turn you down on a parole. Let me see, I keep getting away from 7 block. Is that going right to, is that how?
Well, I think that it would help to sort of get the idea of how you get into the general prison population, and then the kinds of things that have to occur to get you into the board.
Okay. Okay, right.
So they do all of this testing, but it sounds as though they never make any use of it.
No, and the testing isn't, I mean, it isn't very, I mean, these are people who are charged with taking persons who have been declared out of order, you know, something wrong with them. You know, this is when sent to handed over to the authority as slaves, actually, to the Michigan Department of Corrections. And the duty of the Michigan Department of Corrections, evidently, is to correct these people, find out what's wrong with them, and correct them, and send them back out into society to be useful members of society. Well, in order to, you know, this is, I mean, we really have a dichotomy here. This is a constant, this is a propaganda, you see. This is a constant, I mean, we have this whole book is just, I mean, you read it, it's just reasonable, you know, and it sounds like there really is something happening. But what this thing is about in 7 block is that they get you up at 7 o'clock in the morning and take you down to take a test. They don't tell you what it's about. They just take you in a room and give you a piece of paper and say, fill this out, you see. You fill that out. And then they send you back, you know, and you go back and they lock you up and you just lay there. Now maybe the next day, at 10 o'clock in the morning, they take you out and they take you to take another test. And they don't, again, they don't prepare you for the desk, they don't tell you what it's all about. There's about 50, you know, 30 to 50 inmates all taking this test at the same time. And they give you the instructions, and you take the test, and then you go back. And then one, you have one interview with the social, I guess they call them social workers. You have one interview with the social worker. You talk to the social worker. And then you have one interview, perhaps you have an interview with the psychologist, with this guy Kaiser. Have you ever met him? No, he's a humdinger, that guy is. He called me and because he read about me in the papers and he wanted to see what made me tick. I mean, that's essentially the level of the, you know, people that you have in there. If he wasn't working there, he'd be farming in Jackson County somewhere, you know. And, and that certainly goes for the guards, you know, like the guards are all refugees off the farms in Jackson County. And they'd be fine if they were working on farms and breeding cows and, you know, growing corn and stuff like that. But they have absolutely no qualifications for dealing with people. You know, they have no qualifications at all. I mean, they just, can you explain, maybe we should explain that, because the guards and that whole thing, qualifications, how does a guard, have you looked into that?
I haven't looked into it much, except that it seems that they're demanded to have a high school education.
Is that a new, relatively recent requirement?
I don't think so.
It's a civil service position, isn't it?
Yeah. The pay scale, I think the pay scale's in here. Starts at about $8,000 or something like that. I'm not even sure. I read somewhere where it starts around $8,000 and goes up.
The lowest guard.
They're trained in restraint. I read that in some manual, too. That's about all I've heard about the guards. I've seen and talked to a lot of them. You see them when they're changing shifts.
One of the first things you want to start with about the guards is that there's approximately 60% and rising black inmate population.
Over 70.
Is it over 70 now? Over 70% of the prisoners are black. At Jackson, you have maybe 5% black guards and one or, you know.
I've seen a few administrators, about three.
Yeah, about three.
That's about it.
At Marquette, like at Attica, there is not a black face in the whole prison administration and custody tree. There is no black, because no black people live in Marquette, Michigan, you see. If they do, they had a struggle at the college last year, Northern Michigan University, when I was up there in 70, I think. And the Black Students Union was trying to do something at the college, and they had handbills out in the town of Marquette, and the students, the white students, were carrying their hunting rifles and stuff on campus, and they had handbills out saying open season on niggers. So this is a kind of community. Of course, Jackson, the city of Jackson in Jackson County, is one of the most racist areas in the north. For example, Jackson County is where they prosecuted Richard Songer for putting on the Goose Lake Rock Festival, where they took him before a jury and charged him with aiding and abetting in the sales and conspiring to sell marijuana and heroin, where the prosecutor went before the jury and said that this man had put on the Goose Lake Pop Festival only to sell heroin and marijuana to young people. You see, this was a man, and they charged him, and this is a 20-year minimum sentence that they charged him when they took him right through a this is Jackson County. You see, this is where these guards come from. This is where, for example, Senator James Fleming of the Michigan State Legislature comes from Jackson County. He's a former prosecutor. He's the person who led the fight against the new marijuana laws in the state legislature for the past 3 years. He's the reason that it didn't pass in 1970. And he's from Jackson. He's a former prosecutor.
That's not to say that the administration particularly likes the ratio that they have. I mean, this is one of the first things.
Well, that's what they say, though, Rod. God damn it. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Except that they have made attempts to find more blacks in the administration.
Well,
one of the problems is that for what that pays, like for a qualified black in a counseling position who has the qualifications, he can get a lot better job, a lot better pay than in the prison.
They're paying $8,000 to the lowest guard, it would seem, on a relative pay scale, that the administrative personnel would be getting more money, too, because $8,000 is a hell of a lot of money for a guard.
It's more than a teacher makes, isn't it?
Really?
I think so.
Wow.
And they aren't trained in restraint.
See, and that's the point, too, you know. The point there, too, you see, is that they ain't talking about black administrators, but the town of Jackson is full of black people, you know. For 8,000 and something a year, that's a good job. You know, that's a better job than working in the factory. You know, I mean, that, as far as the work that you have to do and the kind of, you know, the kind of position that you have to be in, I mean, they could easily, I mean, if they can find all these rednecks, you know, they could easily find, you know, I mean, they keep talking about correcting it, but I saw a load of recruits come through, two loads. I saw one in probably in September and another one in November. And in the first one, there was about 20 new recruits and there was like one black recruit. You see, this is where the ratio of prisoners is going up all the time. Now, this is something that we have to think about. You know, we read about all this stuff, but this is something you really have to think about. Even in Jackson, you know, where you can listen to soul stations on the radio and where your people can come up and see you from Detroit, if you're black, you're, I mean, and you're in an institution where you're being oppressed anyway, you know, the most severe kind of oppression and repression that exists in this society is being locked in prison. And you, all the administrators, or virtually all the administrators, and virtually all the guards, don't even. The dining hall, for example, where normally you have most of the inmates, white inmates sit on one side, most of the black inmates sit on the other side, as a matter of choice, you know. There isn't any rules against integrating tables or, you know, black and white inmates eating together, but generally it's segregated like that by choice. And it's one of the few areas where inmates can, you know, pick their situation like that.
More so
Perry Johnson went up to Marquette.
Yard. Even more so in the prison yard, if you walk around there and you see how people are congregating.
Yeah.
It's I didn't see one mixed group in the yard in the many times that I've been in there. Out of probably 1,000 inmates in the yard.
Right.
And this is something which can be viewed as working in the favor of the administration in one way, but also I was told that the major paranoia of the staff there is of getting in the middle of a racial conflict, that they aren't as worried about being attacked as the administrators as they are as being in the middle of a racial battle.
Sure.
And so again, this is working against them. When I was talking about the administration and maybe their willingness to get more blacks in, I was basing this on my contact with them. And every time that they have made requests of me to find some personnel from the university, from the academic school to the warden last Wednesday, they stipulated that they would like black people.
And well, they've so got to.
They have to. But at this point, they would accept three black students from the University of Michigan right now. If I took them tomorrow to the warden, they could go in for 10 weeks, three times a week, and work with prisoners in the recreation facilities inside. And he would accept black inmates. And he's willing to do this. I think he has to. But the administration, I think, is recognizing somewhat the need for this. And
oh, yeah, sure they're recognizing.
Their hands are tied in this way.
They're recognizing it when white guards are getting thrown off the third gallery railings as soul dead. You know, they recognize it then. You see, they recognize that they're going to have to do something if they want to keep it under control. But again, if we can bring Travis Jones in here, who is now a big, you know, has been Elvie's one of their boys. You know, he's been put in a position of, he's a black, started out as a guard. And was made it to corporal, and then was taken from that and made a counselor, and then taken from counselor and made administrative assistant to the director of the psychiatric clinic. These are good people. But he's told me, and I like to get him here to talk about, because I asked him about that stuff, you know. And he said he himself had a hell of a time just getting in there as a correctional officer. So they put him through all kinds of changes, you know.
Let's,
and
let's
all,
get him in
here. He really had to be persistent in
I'll
that.
Talk to him next week.
Yeah, I got to call him too. I mean, so they talk, you know, and their propaganda will be in, and they will be making motions toward a more equitable situation in this area, you know. But in fact, when you hear them talking like that, and then you turn around and look at a class of 20 recruits of guards, and there's one black recruit in there, you know, there's something funny going on, you know. We hope to be able to bring some people in to talk about that, you know, who have had direct experience in there, hopefully prisoners. The women's prison is at DeHoko. And they, in essence, they have no women's prison for the state of Michigan, you see. There's about, I believe, and Nancy may know better than I do, 150 state prisoners, women prisoners at DeHoko. Do you know? Right, right, it is. They have no women prison, see, so they sent them to the women's section of the Detroit House of Correction.
There used to be at Jackson. The whole thing started at Jackson. In this first page here, a brief prison history. It says somewhere in here, female convicts were confined at the old institution until 1867, when a legislative act permitted the sentencing of women prisoners to the Detroit House of Correction. So they'd been there for more than 100 years. Well, they have. They've been putting them there for more than 100 years.
Well, the House of Correction.
Yeah, but yeah. They started at Jackson, and were only there for about 30 years or so.
But they actually, see, the House of Correction is a, Detroit House of Correction is an institution for inmates from Wayne County who are doing a year or less. That's what the Detroit House of Correction is, you know, that's what its purpose is. But since they have no women's prison, they send women there, and they're mixed in with women who are doing 90 days for mostly prostitutes, you know, who are doing like 90 days for costing and soliciting and stuff like that, or shoplifting, or other misdemeanor offenses, you know. And whether they're doing life, you know, or a set period of years or 10 days, they're treated essentially the same. I know I did 6 months in 1966 in the men's division of the Detroit House of Correction, and that was the thing about that place. They had people there doing 2 days and 5 days and 10 days for traffic offenses, traffic tickets and stuff like that, along with about 100 men from Jackson that were sent down there. In one barracks, they were all, you know, I had a friend who was doing 10 to 25, or 25 to 40, I guess, for murder, 25 to 40. And he was treated the same, essentially, as somebody who was doing 5 days, you see. I mean, you know, it's just the women in the Detroit House of Correction, in the women's division, the prisoners can't write their boyfriends, for example, or receive visits from their boyfriends, because they might be smuggling dope into them when they kiss them, you see. So, and you can't have more than one, if you're a man or woman prisoner, you can't have more than one friend of the opposite sex who is your, you know, wife or girlfriend or whatever, boyfriend, whatever they call it, you know, husband. So if a prisoner goes to prison, he's down as being, this is what I was saying about when you go in at first, you see, if you put down that you're married, well, like if you're a male prisoner, and you're married, but you and your wife haven't been living together, have no relations whatsoever, and you have a girlfriend, if you put down that you're married, you won't ever be able to see your girlfriend, you know, during the course of your confinement without going through a million changes, you see. And they, at DeHoko, they have a really strict thing where you can't write. If you're married, you can't write to anyone except your spouse, you know, or receive visits from. You see, they determine, the whole point is that just like with this, or haircuts, or anything that you do, you see, they determine. everything that you can do or can't do, you know. They're getting more liberal all the time, but they determine when you can have clothes that are colored like this instead of gray like that, you see. They determine whether you can wear bell-bottom pants or regular pants, you know. They'll determine when your hair can be 1 inch long or 3 inches long, you see. None of this has anything to do with custody or treatment. None of it has anything to do with rehabilitating anybody, you know. But that's just, the whole method is just to keep you like this, you see. And they'll let up a little bit, and if you go along, you know, they'll keep letting it up, and they'll take you from 5 West and put you in 5 East, and then in Blue Hole Card, and then in 6 Block, and then in Population, and then 11 Block, that's the Honor Block, and then if you do good in there, you can get to Trustee Division, and then you can get to a farm, and if you do get on the farm, you can get to the camp, you know, and if you get in the canyon, you can get a furlough to go home for a weekend, you know. And at any time, they can take you from, you can work for 5 years to reach this level, you see, and if you mess up, man, they take you and you start all over again, you know. And it goes the other way, too. They keep putting you farther back, you know. It's like the old songs used to talk about being way back in the jailhouse, you know. They can keep putting you way back until they put you all the way back in Marquette and all the way back in F Block in Marquette, where they used to weld people in, you know. They put you in your cell and they weld you in, and then you stay there for, oh, one guy was there for 6 years, you know, welded into a cell, you see. That's just putting them out of the way, you know. They don't want to be bothered with this guy, you see. What were you going to say?
It's called recidivism.
Right.
It's a really
funny
word.
It's like 83%, isn't it?
They told me 62%.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be par for the course.
62% recidivist rate.
It's a funny thing, because if somebody succeeds in adapting well enough to the prison system, the physical setting and the social setting, then they've adapted themselves out of the ability really to make it in the other world. And so it's sort of a grind, because they're saying, look, here's this 6-foot by 8-foot cell, and here's all these people, and all you gotta do is make yourself comfortable here, and once you do and serve your time, you can go outside. But if you're able to adapt to that system or that setting, it's gonna be pretty hard on the outside to get back into, and you're gonna really want to go back, and that's where the grind is in the prison system. It's you know, talking about rehabilitation or corrections, it's just not there.
Also, what kind of crimes people commit mostly in jail? I mean, you know, what's the typical,
their
most frequent?
Well, no.
Yeah, it's,
there's, I imagine the most common crimes are breaking and entering, stealing cars, armed robbery to various degrees, narcotics and weed violations, forgery, writing bad checks, those are about the main ones.
Yeah, anything
you
is,
have a, always have a number
federal.
Of people for murder, manslaughter, or woman slaughter, as the case may be. You have a small number of people with rape charges, a number of people with statutory rape or indecent liberties or things like that.
Maybe
then you just have the whole gamut of crimes, you know, that exist.
You don't have
too many board chairmen of General Motors, you know, for example. You don't have, as a case in Auburn, Michigan, where two bank employees were apprehended after mismanaging $2.7 million worth of the people's money that had put it in the bank. They were given a personal bond by the court, you know, and when one of them pleaded guilty, I believe he was given probation. You know, you don't have too many people like that. You see, yeah, mainly the kind of people who are regarded by court officials, prosecutors, the average attorney, the corrections officials and people like that is a criminal type, i.e. poor people, you know, people that don't have any money. You know, that's actually usually the criminal type, you see. And you have in the prison population a large percentage of what Huey P. Newton has called illegitimate capitalists. You know, people who, I try to speak to this a little bit in the course outline, about where poor, if poor people attempt to follow the example set by the pillars of society and actually go out and get some money for themselves without working for it, you see, they're subjected to the most severe form of punishment that they have in the state. This is very, I imagine this is very confusing to a lot of people, you know, who read, if you're in prison, you can read things like the books that they have, old books in the Library of Lives of the Great American Financiers, you know, and you read about pirates and ace criminals like the Pierponts and the Morgans and the DuPonts and the Huntington Hartfords and all those people, you see, the Astors and the Rockefellers and the Fords and those people who have essentially gone out and ripped off huge oil wells and, you know, areas of land and ripped off people. If you ever read about the railroad scams of the late 19th century, you know, you see where railroad people would buy land and then trade it to the government for other kinds of land and get the government to pay for their railroads to go through, and then they get the money. These people aren't in the penitentiary, you see. You don't find them in the penitentiary. You find the people who try to emulate their example one way or another. You find people who are swept by the whole idea of easy money, you know, and watch all the commercials on television and all the billboards and all the things about the ads for the banks and we'll give you money and this and that. So who get checkbooks and write checks and go in and pass them out. You see, they end up doing 3 to 14, you know, or 7.5 to 14, or 10 to 14, you know, depending on the number of checks that they wrote. I was different. A political prisoner, it doesn't matter how much money they have. You see, they, you know, Jimmy Hoffa had the whole, you know, one of the largest non-government pressure, you know, power groups in the country, and they put him in the penitentiary for a long time until he agreed not to exercise any of this power anymore, you see.
I can give you an example that I, there was just talking the other day about that.
Let me just run one little thing. Sure. There are some people who have money who end up in their doctors who got caught up in this. I had a good friend who they've almost driven crazy in there, who was a doctor in Detroit who was accused of murdering two of his nurses with sodium pentothal or something like that, you see. And they gave him he got 3 to 15 years for manslaughter. And he is just a doctor, you know, like a nice middle-class guy who tends his patients and stuff like that. I don't know if he took off the nurses or not, you know, but in either case, he's in the penitentiary with this 3 to 15, and they just, it's just totally alien, you know, to, like we talked about those kids from Stanford. Mm-hmm. You see, I mean, you just about have to be poor or come from some kind of background like that to be able to relate to it, or else it'll drive you half nuts, you know. Poor people are used to being, I mean, if you aren't used to having somebody tell you what to do all the time, you know, it gets to be a hard trip, you know. And people who, you know, show the most spirit and the most resistance to being told what to do are those who have the hardest time in the penitentiary. You know, the toady type is the type that's held up as the yassa, you know, anything you say boss type is the type that really gets along in the penitentiary, you know, and gets the best jobs, and, you know.
I got a story about yeah. One of those types that really freaked me. I was in a conference with Dr. Brzezinski, he'll come in here, he's the head of the psychiatric unit there. And he's tied up with the reception clinic, which is supposed to, it's probably about the first time that any corrections person deals with the inmate, the criminal, and asks them about, you know, why he's doing these things. Tries to get down to motivation and that kind of thing. So a young man was sent in to the reception clinic from a small town, and he had been accused and convicted of statutory rape because he disappeared from the town for a while and appeared with a 15-year-old girl who he proceeded to live with. And the people in the town railroaded this through. They didn't like it. They got him convicted, and he went he was going to Jackson to be processed and sent to some institution to serve his time. While he was being interviewed by a psychologist there, he casually revealed that this young girl was his wife. Nowhere in the legal process had this come out. He had just gone through the whole thing. And people said yes. And they said, "Are you living with that girl?" "Yes." Yeah. Went right through it. And he walked into Jackson State Prison. And they were about to assign him to an institution. And nowhere in that process did this person know enough or perhaps care enough to make some complaints about it.
Well, you can make a fortune with him, call the rest of
him. Probably doesn't care enough about it. So he went back to his wife. But you know, this was caught by the psychologists, sharp people. this kind of thing, you know, this kind of person does exist. And
he was probably given a full probation investigation before sentencing, right?
Very strange. Well, they made a few.
And I'm sure if you looked on the statistics of the court that he came from, you would see that he received a full investigation. In this case, received a full investigation by the probation department to make sure they were doing the right thing when they sentenced him. You know.
So you said that once, you know, you worked with a person that his life divided by 8 is earned 5 and 5. Are there any other ways in which they divide you? Like, do they try to keep you away from other prisoners who would be politically?
Oh, definitely, yeah. If they have any inkling that you have any kind of political thing, you know, they want to keep you in some place. Now they're finding that they use the farms and the camps for this. You see, they can send someone to a camp way out in the woods somewhere and keep them out of contact with anybody. You know the David Johnson case that we were, didn't we talk about that? And he brought suit against him. David Johnson was is a member of the Black Panther Party from Detroit, who was one of the Detroit 16, one of the three who were convicted of felonious assault after that whole trial went down. He got 3 to 4 years, was sent to the penitentiary. And David Johnson was classified for MTU, I believe. Was sent to MTU. Maybe I better check that. Maybe he just went to Ionia. He ended up anyway in Ionia, and they charged him with organizing prisoners there and being a political agitator and this and that. They transferred him to 5 East in Jackson and held him there without any charges or any trials or anything like that. And he brought suit through the National Warriors Guild, and his suit is essentially the same as my suit, but not as detailed. And before the suit could go to court, they've now sent him out to trustee division, you see, to get out from under it. But they take people, like if you're rat, you know, like 2 or 3, what they call rap partners, you know, the person that you're arrested with. You know, most people in the penitentiary have rap partners, you know, because they were out stealing cars or breaking into joints or, you know, sticking people up or something like that. And they do it, you know, and the degree of what you'd think of, what you see on TV and read about in the paper and all that about professional criminals, the degree is about that much. You know, usually they're just people, you know, like guys who, especially junkies, you know. Now, the character is more and more that it was people who were shooting dope and involved in various types of criminal activity in order to support their habits who end up in the penitentiary, you know. Who are being in, taking off, coming into your room and taking your TV set and stuff like that, you see.
Something they don't do as far as segregation is, as far as I can tell, and I asked a lot of people about it, they don't consciously try to segregate into different age groups or discriminate by what kind of rap they're in for.
Right.
Sex offenders are not discouraged from being, you know, they just throw them together. So an inmate can be thrown next to any kind of person in the world without any consideration by it.
But none.
So like segregation in California prison systems, they're actively trying in some institutions to segregate prisoners by age, by what kind of crime, trying to use this in a way of, you know, controlling the whole experience inside the prison and the exposures, what they call the bad exposures inside the prison. And at Jackson, this is not done. They just don't do it. They said they don't have time.
Easier.
They say it's they've got enough just juggling to get that bed filled. What they are doing is they're breaking Jackson up into four small
pieces. They want to. Have they gotten authorization for that?
They got federal funds coming.
Oh, they did.
Soon. It looks like it's going to happen, but I asked them if they were going to use that as a means of, you know, segregating by different ages and that, and they didn't seem to be very excited about it. Maybe I was talking to the wrong guy, but this guy was assistant warden.
Which one? Edward?
Is there any kind of rehabilitation for junkies?
None.
There is a drug treatment program.
Well.
But it's operated, it's not at Jackson, it's operated through the psychiatric clinic. The psychiatric clinic serves the whole state, 9,600 inmates. They have a capacity of about...
First you have to be a psychiatric problem.
Right.
First you have to get to top six in order to get into that.
Right. And top six
in order to get
is,
to top six, you have
Jackson.
To do some kind of crazy, you know, something crazy, like eating a light bulb, you know, or...
There's a drug program.
I had a friend who ate a light bulb to get out of the hole, you know, and he's been classified as crazy ever since. You see, he just had to, that was the only way he could get out, you know, it was the only thing he could do, and he was just desperate to get out of the hole. He took his light bulb out and ate it, you know, in order to get to the psychiatric clinic. And the problem with that is, though, that once you get classified from there, you see, they know always, if they want to put you away, they know I say that you went crazy, you know, and put you back in there. In order to get into this drug program, which sounds like, and maybe Pesesky here or someone from his department can tell us about it, it sounds like a fairly decent thing. They have a drug community, actually, what they call it. They have a section of a ward where, but these are, again, these aren't just the average person who has a drug problem. This is a person who's crazy, you know, who they classify as crazy. See, it's psychiatrically unbalanced.
And then they're phased back in. There is a drug program through activities. Through
called the, Narcotics Anonymous.
And there's a waiting list of 200 to get into it.
And the only reason anybody goes to it is because when you go to the parole board and you're in there and it says on your record you have a narcotics problem, they tell you you have to go to Narcotics Anonymous, you see, which is like a session where maybe 15 or 20 dudes sit around a table and just talk. You know?
Right.
Actually, from what I understand, they talk more about how good it was shooting dope and stuff like that than they do with...
And even that, they can't expand because of the staff.
You see, they can't deal with a drug problem because to deal with a drug problem means you have to deal with the whole structure of the society, you know, and you have to deal with the whole why people are shooting dope, you know. And if you deal with crime, same thing with the crime, they can't deal with the crime problem, you see. To eliminate crime, you have to eliminate a whole social system, which is, you know, which is set up, which the guy with a gun sticking up somebody is the apotheosis of capitalism. You know, that's what capitalism is all about, is going up and sticking somebody up, you know. So you have that problem. You see, you really can't condemn the armed robber, you know, from the government's point of view. You see, they're caught in this weird contradiction. How do they tell this guy, you know, that he should put down his gun and go out? The idea of rehabilitation is somebody going out and working 8 hours in the factory and putting their money in the bank and buying a house and a car, you know, if they let them buy a car, and making the payments every month and brushing their teeth with Ipana and using Arid under their arms and, you know, all the rest of the stuff, you know. So it's really, I mean, they really can't deal. To deal with the drug problem, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of inmates, particularly a lot of black inmates now, who are really interested in dealing with the drug problem, you know, and who know that to deal with the drug problem means to deal with the whole problem of exploitation of the black community, for example, and the whole problem of the CIA bringing opium in from Southeast Asia, and all who know that those are the ones who are taken and put in the hole, you see, because they're agitators, you know. People really have a genuine concern about dealing with the drug, want to talk to other inmates and talk to them about when they go back out in the street, instead of falling into the same patterns of shooting dope and ripping off stores and people's houses and stuff like that, who want to get into free breakfast programs, you know, and who want to get into activities in the communities, you know, to deal with the exploitation and oppression of their communities. This is totally discouraged. You know, just told him not discouraged. This is just doused, you know. This is the most, you can't, you know, you simply can't do that. And the alternative to it is Narcotics Anonymous, you see. So, and then anything in between. So people are actually encouraged to, like, revive all their memories of what it was like shooting dope and to glorify that whole experience. And if somebody comes in and tries to say, you're just a dupe of the government when you do stuff like that. You see, you try to run some kind of analysis of it on them. Those people are taken up and arrested and put in the hole, stuff like that, you see. So the average inmate again and again sees that it is not in his interest, you see, to do anything that is not mapped out for him by the prison administration, or else he'll just get locked up. And the average prisoner has a more or less indeterminate sentence with a minimum and a maximum, and has to earn a parole, you know. And so they get to the point where any kind of organizing among themselves to deal with any of their problems, it has to be weighed against the possibility of discharging off your sentence in 5 years rather than getting a parole after 1 year, you see. So, I mean, all of these things are set up to keep people from, prisoners from organizing or getting themselves together, or, you know, even making an attempt to deal with the narcotics problem, say.
Well, if they classify you as crazy, will they ever transfer you to a mental institution?
They can. They know I send you to Ione State Hospital for the criminally insane. Where, God, I wish we could get somebody from there in here.
Maybe Pasetsky would know someone.
Yeah, I mean an inmate, though.
Stone.
I only stay at hospital for the criminally insane at the end of the line, you know. I don't know. I've met guys who have done like 5 years there or 10 years there and were sent back to Jackson. You know, and they're like, they just, you know, they've given them shock treatments and beaten them and pissed on them and all that stuff. And that. Or they're just weird, you know. Like they'll be all right, you'll be talking to them and everything will be all right, and all of a sudden they'll just get weird, you know. They just aren't, they'll regress to some infantile stage or something, you know, right where you're talking. I mean, they're ruined, you know, burned out. And they can send them there, you know. I mean, that's always, you know, you're always aware of the fact that they can always just take a piece of paper like this. I mean, I've got a whole file here where they declared me to be all kinds of weird shit. So they could just as easily have taken one of these pieces of paper and said, this man is insane, and ship him to Ionia. Well, the head of the psychiatric clinic, for one, I'm sure, you know. I mean, I'm sure he could get orders from the Department of Corrections, you know, that, you know, this is strange, see, because the director of the psychiatric clinic, as I think we were seeing before, is strangely enough, is the most progressive person that I met anyway in the whole penal system. He and his assistant, Travis Jones, who I consider a friend of mine, Travis Jones, you see. These are the two most progressive people that I met in the whole system. Now, I thought that the psychiatric clinic would be headed by people of the caliber of Jerry Hansen, you know, or the director of treatment, or by any of the bureaucrats, you see. So maybe it's because this guy is halfway all right, you know, and hopefully he'll be here and we'll be able to see him for ourselves, you know.
He said he would come.
I mean, the average prison official who would have a job like that, you know, would just be a person who would follow orders handed down from Lansing. So if Gus Harrison, the director of corrections, sent down orders, send Sinclair to Ionia State Hospital, you know, and fix it up, you see, the average lackey of the Department of Corrections would actually just fix it up. You know, they've done that to people that they wanted to get rid of.
It filters down, though, from the high levels. A guard doesn't say, you know,
oh, no.
Be locked up.
No. A guard can have you admitted to the psychiatric clinic by writing out a little report, and they do many times. You know, a lot of guys go to do weird things to, like, sit and eat cigarettes or stuff. You know, they'll be sitting in quarantine and just... And the guard, why, they do it on purpose. I had a little kid next to me one time who looked like he was about 14, you know. He must have been 17 or 18. A little blonde kid. They put him in the cell next to mine, which is right up by the desk, when I was in quarantine. And he was kind of hyper, you know,